Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's. Today's program is the CLL. We're partnering with the chronic with the CLL Society on today's program and Cancer Care. And the program is titled Current Perspectives on the Treatment of Relapsed Refractory Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. And this is part two of Living with Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, or CLL. And today's program is supported by AbbVie and a contribution from Lilly. And I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, just before we begin, I want to say a few things. We have over 120 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants today from Canada, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So this is indeed a global call, and it's really wonderful that all of you are on this call, taking an hour to listen, to learn more about the treatment of relapsed refractory CLL. So I'd just like to thank everybody for participating in these questions. It really helps us to best tailor the programs to meet your needs. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our next speaker, our first speaker, actually. And our first speaker is Dr. Christine Ryan. And Dr. Ryan is a physician, Division of Lymphoma, Center for Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, CLL, instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Ryan will be addressing review of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, significant role of testing and informing your treatment choices, and first-line treatment choices. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Ryan.
Listener, I'd like to start by thanking you for the very kind invitation to be here today, and also to add my thanks to Cancer Care, the CLL Society, and the other sponsors for the opportunity to be part of this seminar. So, Dr. Messner, as you mentioned, in the next several minutes, I'll give a brief overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. We'll discuss some of the key testing that we perform for our patients with CLL, and then I'll give a brief overview of first-line treatment options. So, what is chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL? This is a type of blood cancer, and specifically, the cancerous cell in CLL is a cell of the immune system that we call a lymphocyte. So lymphocytes are a normal part of our immune system, and they have several important roles, which include helping fight infection. And we have different types of lymphocytes. In the case of CLL, the cancerous cell is something called a B lymphocyte, B as in boy. And so basically what happens with CLL is at some point in time, a B lymphocyte goes rogue or basically gets misprogrammed and finds a way to live longer than usual without dying off properly. And it makes copies of itself that also live longer without dying off properly. So over time, these cells accumulate or they amass in the body. And they can accumulate in different parts of the body. So sometimes they accumulate, and often they do accumulate, in areas of the body called lymph nodes. These are glands of the immune system where lymphocytes are normally found or where they normally live, as one way of thinking about it. And so when the CLL cells accumulate in the lymph nodes, they will make the lymph nodes get bigger over time. And sometimes that is how the disease is diagnosed, is that a patient may notice that they have a new lump in their neck or under their arm or in their groin area. Now, these CLL cells can also accumulate in the bloodstream. And so sometimes patients are diagnosed because they go in for routine blood work or have blood sent for a different reason, and it's found that they have an abnormally high number of what are called white blood cells. So lymphocytes are a type of white blood cell, and that's why in patients with CLL, we see that their lymphocyte count is high and also their overall white blood cell count is high. Now, there are different tests that can be completed to sort of characterize certain features of a patient's CLL cells. And these tests are important because they can help the treating physician understand a little bit more about the biology of the CLL cells and can help gauge whether or not a patient's CLL may have more or less aggressive biology. So to explain about a couple of these tests, first, I'll explain that one of the tests looks at what are called the chromosomes in the cancer cells. And this testing is called cytogenetic testing. It also involves something called FISH, F-I-S-H testing. And the results that we receive as physicians are often in what's called a karyotype. And basically, this is a readout of the chromosomes, the pattern of chromosomes in the CLL cells. So it is common in CLL cells for portions of certain chromosomes of the cell to be missing, and that pattern has implications for potentially how quickly the CLL might progress or grow or how fast these cancer cells might accumulate. Now, I just want to emphasize that we're talking about chromosomes and genetic changes. These are specific to the CLL cells. These are not necessarily genetic changes that a patient may have received from their parent or passed down to their children. These are genetic changes specific to the cancer cells themselves. So again, one test is looking at the chromosomes. Another important test is something called IGVH mutational testing. And this is a test that looks at rearrangements of some of the immune-related proteins of the CLL cell. Now, the two options for a readout for this IGVH mutational testing is either for it to come back what's called mutated or unmutated. And what we know is that the IGHV mutated status tends to be associated with a slower growing CLL, and that from the time of diagnosis, a patient may have a longer time until they need to start treatment for the CLL. I will say sometimes this test comes back as a word called indeterminate, or basically the test can't be completed, and that doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It just means that the test couldn't be resulted. And then another very important test that we send is looking at something called the TP53 mutational status. Again, that's TP53. So the TP53 gene is a gene that can be mutated in a lot of different cancers. And when we find that it is abnormal, it tends to confer a more aggressive biology to the cancer. And that holds true for CLL as well. Now, the TP53 gene is found on a particular chromosome. And so when we send the chromosome test, we can see if the gene is missing, if the chromosome, the part of the chromosome that has the gene, isn't there. So that's one way to test for the TP53 status. But it's also very important, if possible, to send an actual test for the gene itself to see if the sequence of the gene is abnormal, meaning it's mutated, or if it's normal. And taking all of these results together, the chromosome analysis, the IGHV mutational status, and the TP53 mutational status, these results are helpful as we are thinking about the best first-line treatment for our patients with CLL. I realize I'm almost at my time, so I'll just try to very briefly talk about first-line treatment options. I will say, I just want to emphasize that for many patients, when they are first diagnosed with CLL, they actually enter into active observation, something also called watch and wait, and that involves continuing to monitor for signs of the CLL progressing or growing to the point of needing treatment. And so very, very briefly, in terms of first-line treatment options, the two most standard options, and I will also say that, you know, I recognize we have a global audience, so these options may differ by which country you are living in and what has been approved as a standard in your country. But in the United States, our two most standard options in five, either a single pill, which is taken until it stops working. Those pills are called BTK inhibitors, and those are drugs like acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. And the other standard option is a combination of a pill plus an antibody therapy, which is given intravenously or through a vein in the arm. And that regimen is what we call a fixed duration. So it's given for just a little over 1 year, and it involves taking the pill and getting monthly infusions. And overall, that regimen is a little bit more intensive logistically, especially when starting. So Dr. Messner, maybe I'll stop there because I realize I'm at my 8 minutes, or I can continue whatever you think is best.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ryan. That was an excellent presentation. And since you're the first speaker, you set the tone for today's program. So you've given a lot of good information and wonderful information, actually stellar information, to our participants about CLL. And we're going to build on that. And so our next speaker is Dr. Christopher Jensen. And Dr. Jensen is Clinical Assistant Professor, Lymphoma Program, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Dr. Jensen will be addressing treatment of relapsed refractory CLL, retesting importance in determining treatment for second and third line treatments, and current perspectives on new and emerging treatments of CLL. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Jensen.
Well, thank you, Dr. Messner, for that kind introduction. I'd like to also extend my thanks to Cancer Care and the CLL Society for organizing this session and inviting me to participate. You know, I think a lot of what we think about in terms of treatment for relapsed or refractory or CLL that has not responded or grown again after initial treatment really builds on what Dr. Ryan was discussing in terms of first-line treatment. I would say broadly, the principles that Dr. Ryan was outlining really inform our approach to second line or later line treatment as well. You know, those principles are that, you know, not all CLL that is measurable needs to be treated. For folks that don't seem to be having active symptoms, low blood counts, or really bulky disease, we may also enter into a period of sort of watchful waiting or an active surveillance approach after CLL becomes detectable again. But in sort of similar fashion, if the CLL becomes active or seems to be causing symptoms, low blood counts, or other problems, we think about pursuing a second type or second line of treatment. You know, in the U.S., the current treatment approach for second line or initial relapse CLL is very similar to what we do in the first line, where the backbone of treatment options consist of either the BTK inhibitors, like Dr. Ryan mentioned, or venetoclax-based treatment options as a time-limited therapy. Most of the time, we're thinking about switching to the alternative treatment class, or the if folks have been previously treated with a BTK inhibitor, our typical approach is to reach for venetoclax second. And if people have been previously treated with the venetoclax therapy, venetoclax-based combination, we typically reach for a BTK inhibitor. That is largely informed by the fact that any time we go back to the same well for treatment for cancer in general and CLL in particular, we expect diminishing returns by using the same agents again. But that strategy may need to be individualized. If folks have come off treatment, had a good experience with a drug previously, in terms of side effects, had a good response that lasted for some time, retreatment with a similar medicine or the same medicine may be something to consider on an individual basis. The additional factors that we want to think about are potentially revisiting testing or risk stratification testing. Dr. Ryan gave us a good overview of the type of testing we think about performing. And at least some of that may be helpful to repeat as CLL becomes active for a second or later time. While the IgVH status, or the immunoglobulin heavy chain status, typically does not change over the disease course if CLL evolves, it we can see changes in the cytogenetics or the chromosomal testing, and we can see the emergence of new TP53 mutations. So repeating those tests, pieces of the risk stratification testing could be helpful for informing sort of expectations moving forward. The other piece of testing that can sometimes be helpful, not necessarily at the outset, but potentially for later line treatment, is actual mutation testing or genetic testing of the BTK molecule, where particularly for individuals treated with a BTK inhibitor, the presence of a new BTK mutation may inform what kind of treatment we want to consider for second or later lines of therapy. When we get past second line treatment, if folks have had CLL that's become active, required initial therapy, become active again and required a second line, and then become active yet again for a third time, we do have some new medicines that have become available really over the last year or so commercially in the United States that can be helpful for management of later lines of CLL treatment. Specifically, I'm thinking about the emergence or the approval of the third-generation BTK inhibitor known as pirtobrutinib. Pirtobrutinib seems to be active in at least some cases of CLL that have already seen or already been treated with one of the earlier generations of BTK inhibitors. And we've also seen the approval of more advanced or what are called cell therapies, therapies that rely on the immune system rather than a pharmacological agent to attack the CLL. In particular, we've seen the approval in this third line space of something called Lysocell or the brand name Breyanzi, one of the CAR T cell products that has activity in CLL and has been approved by the FDA in the U.S. for use for third line treatment of CLL. And I think this sort of the emergence of these agents, their success in clinical trials, even for people that have had multiple prior lines of CLL treatment, is a very encouraging development and can potentially lead in to Dr. Hample's planned discussion of the role of clinical trials for management of CLL in the relapse setting.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jensen. It's an excellent presentation, stellar, and very informative, and I know there'll be questions for you also during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Paul Hempel, and Dr. Hempel is Assistant Professor of Medicine and Oncology, Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Cancer Center, and Dr. Hempel will be addressing updates on clinical trials and their significance for chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, key questions to ask and re-ask your healthcare team, and practical and psychosocial support to cope with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hempel.
Thanks so much, Dr. Mesner, and echoing the gratitude to Cancer Care and CLL Society and the sponsors for the opportunity to be on the call with you all today. So my colleagues, Dr. Ryan and Dr. Jensen, have nicely set up this final piece of the discussion before our Q&A, introducing the different treatments that are commonly used, and then leading into how clinical trials are further informing the use of these agents and agents that are coming down the pike. So to pick up where Dr. Jensen left off, the third generation or non-covalent BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib, so binds that key molecule, that key cog in the machinery of these cancer cells, CLL cancer cells called BTK, is currently FDA approved in the United States for patients who have previously received both of those other classes of drugs, the two oral classes of drugs that Dr. Ryan and Dr. Jensen had mentioned, BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors or venetoclax. And that's the exact same space that the CAR T cell therapy or Lysocell is also approved as of March 2024. The first trial, so we'll talk about a couple trial updates pertaining to those two agents, and then also talk about the more promising or furthest developed agents that are coming next. And so regarding pirtobrutinib, the clinical trial that was updated in December at our large meeting, ASH, is the Bruin 321 study. And so this looked at all people with relapsed CLL who had previously received one of those first or second generation BTK inhibitors, ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, or zanubrutinib. And they were then randomized to receiving either pirtobrutinib or a comparator arm of chemoimmunotherapy regimen, bendamustine and rituximab, or a different class of oral drugs not as commonly used called PI3 kinase inhibitors or idelalisib with rituxan. The take-home here is that pirtobrutinib again showed efficacy in this randomized study, which has led to not yet an update in the approval in the label, but an update in the NCCN guidelines that often give access to patients per Medicare reimbursement based on the category of recommendation in those guidelines that allows pirtobrutinib to be considered in patients who have not yet received venetoclax and have just been previously treated with one of the covalent BTK inhibitors. So that is a promising option for when patients are discussing with their healthcare team what are the best options next for me and the pros and cons logistically and otherwise for consideration there. From the CAR T-cell therapy, so these, again, are very unique treatments where the pirtobrutinib in this setting of patients who have received both of those two prior lines of our mainstays of targeted drugs, BTK inhibitors and BCL2 inhibitors, will work for the majority of people but have a ceiling that we know is going to generally be lower than with those drugs used earlier in the treatment course as first line or second line perhaps. CAR T-cell therapy won't work for as many people, but when it does work very well, it has the highest ceiling of all amongst the treatments we're talking about here, meaning these are ones that can be very, very durable for many years. And that's the update that we saw again in the latest updates from the trial that led to the approval of liso-cel in the relapsed DLL space, where patients who had that best response had great durability of those remissions, meaning they lasted for a long time. And actually, longer-term outcomes from patients treated on a different study, not with the approved product, but with a CAR-T product nonetheless, where the duration of how long those responses lasted was really, really encouraging. In addition to that, there were updates that looked at combining one of these BTK inhibitors with CAR T-cell therapy to hopefully improve upon the number of people that get into that most favorable response and have those longest outcomes. So I think because the immune dysfunction that the CLL is associated with, that meaning the other good immune cells don't work as well, that's been a hindrance to the development and how well these types of treatments, meaning CAR-T in particular, can work in people with CLL. I think there's great reason for optimism, for encouragement that these may yet be optimized further so more patients can benefit from a potential revolutionary therapy. So as far as what's coming down the pike next, they kind of fall, you know, I'll put them within the context maybe of these two classes of drugs, one being BTK degraders, so again, targeting that same key cog in the machinery, the BTK molecule, but in a different way that allows these drugs to work even after they've seen all of the other BTK inhibitors, other targeted drugs that we've all three talked about so far. This is, again, something that likely will work in the majority of people, but have a ceiling that is the duration, how long those may work may not be measured in many, many years per se, as much as a less durable response perhaps. The other class would be and so there were two updates on different BTK degraders that were presented that we won't go into detail for the sake of time, but encouraging in this setting. The other is something called a bispecific antibody, and there's a few of these being developed, but the one that's furthest along in CLL being a drug called epcoritamab. And this is using the same concepts a bit as CAR T, and that you're using your own immune system again to help attack and treat the cancer. Here, many on the call may be familiar with the anti-CD20 antibodies of rituximab or obinutuzumab. This one has that CD20 arm, but also has another piece that grabs CD3, which is on T cells, your good immune cells. And so it's really trying to bring the T cells that are already in your body together with the bad guys, with the CLL cells to efficacy. And so this one, you know, I think might fall ultimately somewhere between these types of therapies, the targeted drugs that work, you know, in the majority of people, but may not work for as long as something or have as high of a ceiling as something like CAR T cell therapy. Maybe bispecific antibodies will fall somewhere in between there. So in short, kind of further encouraging updates from the trials in the setting of drugs that we already have available, the CAR T cell therapy product Glycocel and Pirtobrutinib, and also encouraging updates that we're not collectively leaning back and saying the work here is done, but still trying to innovate to make the current treatments better and to offer additional options into the toolbox. Briefly kind of transitioning then to the questions to ask and the practical and psychosocial support, we'll kind of weave these together a bit, in that I think first off, just acknowledging that CLL does have a profound impact on quality of life for many people, and these can be appreciated in the more general or overall sense, but also broken down specifically into components such as physical or emotional well-being. And with most patients, people being diagnosed incidentally, as Dr. Ryan mentioned, without physical or functional impact necessarily, this sense of nothing being done, you know, quote unquote, during the watch and wait, or unfortunately often referred to as quote watch and worry period, can lead to emotional distress. So I think having open discussions with your team can help, so that they know what you're thinking and you're not making assumptions that may or may not be correct. The testing that's been discussed can help kind of individualize the follow-up and the plan for you, so that this is more of an active surveillance of individualizing your care and making sure that everyone's on the same page, so there's not misplaced worries. And I like the name of this being, you know, living with chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I'll take this from a patient actually that said, "I'm going to do watch and live. You do the watching. You do the, you know, watching and worrying for me, and I'll do the living part." And I think that's important things to keep in mind. The support is certainly for the people that are closest to you, your friends and family and your care team, and also through avenues like this and support groups. So I think, you know, that's important, while still acknowledging each person living with CLL is going to walk their own unique path with the disease. The experiences will vary, but it's critical to have the support of others who are traveling with you on that journey. And I'll stop there for the sake of time. Sorry, I'm running a little over there.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Campbell. That was a superb presentation, really stellar, and a lot of excellent information for participants. I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Fernando Parra Chong, and Mr. Chong is the Strategic Partnerships Manager for the CLL Society, Inc., and he will be addressing the CLL Society's free programs and services, and he also will be going over how to contact the CLL Society. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Mr. Chong.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today representing CLL Society. I'm excited to share with you a little bit about who we are and what we have to offer. CLL Society operates under the guidance of a medical advisory board composed of leading CLL experts, as well as a patient advisory board made up of patient volunteers representing a diverse cross-section of CLL and SLL patients. This ensures that our information is up-to-date, relevant, and reliable. Today, I'd like to briefly share a summary of our free patient education and support services. You can find more details about each of these programs on our website at clsociety.org, the go-to resource for all things CLL. Our patient education toolkit provides topical handouts for patients to read, post on the fridge, or bring to doctor's appointments. The CLL Medicine Cabinet offers comprehensive information on each of the currently approved CLL treatments. Our website also features information on upcoming CLL-related programming, including webinars and other live or virtual events hosted by CLL Society and other reputable organizations. Across the country, CLL and SLL patients, along with their care partners, benefit from participating in one of our 40 CLL-specific support groups. These groups meet virtually and are always welcoming new members. For podcast fans, tune in into CareCast, CLL Society's new podcast channel, where members of the CLL community share their experiences. If you have specific CLL-related questions, our Ask the Experts email forum provides reliable answers. For personal support, our peer-to-peer support program connects you with someone else who has CLL and understands your journey. If you prefer spiritual guidance, our emotional and spiritual advocate is available to connect with you. Additionally, our innovative expert access program offers patients a free virtual second opinion consultation with a world-renowned CLL expert. These are just a few of the many resources and activities CLL Society provides. To stay informed, we encourage patients and their care partners to sign up for our weekly newsletter, CLL Society This Week, and visit the What's New section of our website. You can also follow CLL Society on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. While we are proud to reach thousands, we know that approximately 200,000 Americans are living with a CLL diagnosis. Our mission is to connect with those who are still missing out on the critical resources CLL Society has to offer. We invite you to join our community and experience cutting-edge information, heartfelt support, and meaningful connections. We're here to help ensure you receive the best care and live your best life. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Chong. And I know that you have a wonderful tagline for the participants. An informed consumer is our best. And being an informed consumer is best. So you can get all your information that you need about CLL from the CLL Society's website. Okay. I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services, and then we're going to ask you a few questions, and then we will go right to the Q&A. So I'm sure you're having all your questions. Don't forget to post your questions online. So I'm Carolyn Messner, and I'm a Senior Director of Education Training with Cancer Care, and I want to go over with you the services, the free programs and services that Cancer Care offers. So We offer programs to people nationally throughout the country, and many people call our HOPE line in the United States. It's 800-813-4673. And that number, many people call it for help with practical, financial, and co-payment assistance. They also call the HOPE line for help with transportation or with a psychosocial question that they may have in terms of coping. Or an issue around social determinants of health or food insecurity. So we get lots of calls, and I have to say that the line is staffed by our oncology social workers, and they are on the calls at a particular time, so there is no wait time to have an oncology social worker get back to you. They're right there, and they pick up the phone and answer your question. And if we're not able to provide the resource for you, they will connect you to resources. We also offer resource navigation, so helping people to find resources in their community or their state or nationally. So we have a host of programs, and you can find out all about them by going to our website, www.cancercare.org. And now we're going to go right over to the Q&A. So I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions online, and we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. Bella?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
This is a question from one of our participants, for Dr. Ryan. If a person had a severe, unresponsive, needed epinephrine on the first dose of ibrutinib and is now listed as allergic to it. What does that mean for future treatments? Currently on acalabrutinib, but wondering about future and options if relapse occurs. Thank you. If you could answer this in a general way.
Sure. Dr. Mazur, could I just clarify the drug that the first drug you mentioned is ibrutinib?
It's OBIN.
Oh, obinutuzumab.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry. And so the patient is currently on acalabrutinib?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit hard, I guess, without having all of the information. I will say that infusion-related reactions are very common with the drug obinutuzumab. This is because it's a very powerful drug, and depending on the circulating, what we call white blood cell count or lymphocyte count, or basically the amount of CLL cells that are in the bloodstream when the obinutuzumab is first given, it can cause a very severe reaction that can include things like low blood pressure and even sometimes patients feeling short of breath, et cetera. So I think without knowing further details about that specific event with the initial administration of the obinutuzumab, it's hard for me to really comment whether or not the patient can or cannot receive more obinutuzumab. Oftentimes for the first dose, we will administer it through what's called a split dose process, where just a small amount is given on the first day, usually 1/10 of the total dose, and then 9/10 of the dose given on the second day. If possible, for patients where I'm concerned, and if it's available at your institution or maybe at an institution you can have a consultation visit at, seeing an allergist would be very helpful so that you can undergo formal testing to understand if you truly have an anaphylactic allergy. And if that's the case, sometimes patients can still tolerate receiving a different monoclonal antibody, or they can receive the antibody safely through a process called desensitization. So I would really encourage, first of all, without having all the information, but encourage the patient to explore those options with their provider and or the possibility of seeing an allergist before not being able to receive that medication further.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And this is a question for Dr. Jensen. Others may want to weigh in on it as well, but I'm going to start with Dr. Jensen. With cuts or potential cuts to NIH, FDA, et cetera, what impact will this have on clinical trials and development of new treatment for CLL?
Yeah, I think the short answer is we're in a little bit of an uncertain situation. I think it's ultimately kind of unknown what to expect in terms of impacts. You know, I think we've, both at our institution and elsewhere, been fairly successful in partnering with, pharmaceutical companies, AbbVie, folks that have been sponsoring this session, who have been, key drivers along with NIH in terms of advancing the science and treatment of CLL, but I do worry about potential impacts of cuts in NIH funding. I think aside from just treatment, some of the basic biology or some of the basic science work that goes into informing treatments of the future, it may impact the sort of drug pipeline down the road more than it does today.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Does anyone else want to comment on this? You did a very good job, actually. Dr. Jensen, thank you so much. It's an excellent question. It's one that I think people are kind of wondering about as well. So thank you, Dr. Jensen, for your clear perspective on this. And we have a question for Dr. Hempel. Are there any updates on efficacy of PEMGARDA? My MD refused to prescribe it due to lack of clinical trials.
Yeah, so this is a
an antibody, I think, from a preventative perspective, a primary prophylaxis or preventative perspective for COVID-19. I haven't seen any recent data that I'm aware of. I think that drug does have a, you know, people are maybe familiar with these throughout the pandemic, where we went through various iterations of these types of antibody drugs that were, I think, mostly anti-spike protein, but essentially antibodies to try and prevent the severe or any COVID-19 infection, or some that were used as secondary prevention after an exposure, or some that were even, I think, in the treatment perspective. And due to how much that virus changes, then they'd have a temporary approval and then it would lose efficacy and then a new one would come along. So most of these, I think, have fallen by the wayside. PEMGARDA, I think, is the exception here. And they have a slightly different platform where they are adjusting this, I think, to reflect the virus as it changes as well. So I believe this is approved, actually. The difference is that it's not approved with full coverage the way that the earlier ones were in an emergency setting. I don't know that, you know, I'm not saying this has a full approval, but this is something that has some approval that can be obtained. I think it's important to talk with your insurance company to know how much you may be financially at risk for with the treatment, and also with your team to understand exactly how much, you know, what are really your risks individualized to you with COVID at present, and then how much benefit do you think that this is adding in your particular scenario to come up with the right decision for you on whether or not this is worth it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Ryan. How do zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib differ from the other?
Sure. So acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib are what we call second generation BTK inhibitors. The first generation BTK inhibitor is a drug called ibrutinib. In many countries, actually, ibrutinib is still the only BTK inhibitor available, and it works very well to treat CLL. One of the main differences is that the way the drugs are designed in the second generation cases is that they are more targeted or more specific for that key cog in the wheel. One of my colleagues described it so nicely as that of the CLL cell. And so it inhibits BTK more specifically, and as such, if these drugs, we see less side effects than we do with the ibrutinib. There is also data that in some cases, the second generation BTK inhibitor, specifically zanubrutinib, works better than that first generation drug ibrutinib. But I would say that in terms of using it for patients and their treatment, the main difference we see is in the number of side effects that patients have. And we tend to see less side effects with acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Dr. Jensen. So the question is, the combo trial was ibrutinib plus venetoclax. If this combo is FDA approved, will it be possible to substitute a lower side effect BTKI, such as acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, if available?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think to that very point of Dr. Ryan just made about the second generation BTK inhibitors seem to have fewer side effects than ibrutinib, while being at least as equally effective when they're studied alone. You know, I think as far as getting coverage for medicines, whether an FDA approval of the ibrutinib and venetoclax combination would allow for flexibility, I think is unknown. But fortunately, You know, we do have very recent results from the AMPLIFY trial, which looked at more directly at combinations of venetoclax and the second generation BTK inhibitor, acalabrutinib. I think it's likely that those results will more directly lead to NCCN or national guideline recommendations allowing for the use of acalabrutinib and venetoclax together and potentially regulatory approval through the FDA at some point in the future.
Excellent. Thank you.
This is Paul Hample. I might just, with the global audience, I mean, I think this may be particularly relevant in EU countries where ibrutinib and venetoclax did get approval, despite it not being, FDA label approved here in the U.S., though it's included in NCCN guidelines, so I don't think the uptake for ibrutinib and venetoclax was very high here in the U.S. As of last month now, based on the trial, exactly as Dr. Jensen said, I think if you want to prescribe acalabrutinib and venetoclax, you can, and it will be covered per a Category 1 recommendation in those. And I've done this a few times so far, and it has been approved, at least for Medicare age, and actually one patient who's on commercial insurance also. So I think as far as Zanu, that would be a different ballgame, and calling it a little bit more outside of the lines from what you're able to do for guidelines and approval, but I think as of March 28th, 2025, if that's the desired approach, at least in the first-line setting, I know this is a relapsed and refractory talk, but in the first-line setting, that's listed.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. The question for Dr. Hempel, what is the Richter transformation? Are most RR CLL patients at risk?
I'm sorry, the question is which patients are at greatest risk?
For Richter transformation.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Richter transformation is one of my areas of interest and expertise within CLL as well. So for those on the call that are not familiar, Richter transformation is the development of an aggressive lymphoma in the setting of someone who has CLL. So most commonly, this is an aggressive lymphoma called diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And fortunately, it's a very rare event. So this is something that many patients and their physicians will worry about, but fortunately occurs in less than 10% of people over their entire disease course over their life. The things that Dr. Jensen, Dr. Ryan had kind of talked about as generally being higher risk for more aggressive CLL disease biology. Some of those ultimately end up being enriched also in people who end up having a higher risk for Richter's transformation. There's some very specific molecular findings that are still being described and explored to impart a higher risk for ultimately developing Richter transformation. But there is no one test or collection of tests that we are able to do at present in someone who's newly diagnosed or in the course of their treatment that says you are going to develop Richter transformation or you for sure will not. I'd say one encouraging bit on this is that recent data from our group had suggested that there appears to perhaps be a lower risk in people who have not received any chemotherapy. So whereas any receipt of prior CLL treatment seemed to potentially increase the risk of subsequent Richter transformation, that doesn't appear to be as pronounced, at least in people who've not received any conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy, the fludarabine and the bendamustine, those types of chemotherapies as opposed to targeted drugs. Where that risk still persists, doesn't get rid of it, it just didn't seem to amplify it the way that prior treatments may have.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And see a question for Dr. Ryan. Can patients who have had CLL for a longer time experience memory loss? My father has lived with the disease for several years and recently started experiencing issues with his memory and general brain fog.
I'm sorry to hear that. We don't necessarily think about a long-term side effect of CLL being memory loss or cognitive dysfunction. That is a very challenging medical condition to really pinpoint a specific etiology, and it is unfortunately common as patients and people age as well. It can be very multifactorial. So it is hard for me to say that it would be directly related to the CLL.
Awesome. Thank you. So it might be worth just discussing it with your physician and perhaps determining the cause of this.
Yes, absolutely. I would recommend undertaking, a broader workup, and there are multiple other tests that can be sent, and also, if available or an option, and depending on the severity of symptoms, seeing a specialist like a neurologist for further evaluation would also be very warranted.
Excellent, thank you. And in terms of, I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway for today's program. So I'll start with Dr. Ryan with your takeaway for today's program.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you again for the opportunity, and thank you to our audience for listening and for the many excellent and well-informed questions. I think one thing I would emphasize, I just want to kind of circle back to something Dr. Hample had said, because I was sort of talking about upfront treatment, and I do just want to make the point that I think that the watch and wait, or the watch and live, as he described, approach can be really challenging for patients mentally and emotionally. And so I think that if you as a patient, or you as a family member or caretaker of a patient are feeling that way, I just want to say that it's very common. And I do think that it's really important that you discuss that with your treatment team, and also really encourage you to take advantage of the resources that you heard about through Cancer Care and CLL Society, and hopefully can find support and encouragement as you go through this journey. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Jensen, your takeaway.
Yeah, I think other than that sort of great sort of key point that Dr. Ryan highlighted, I'd like to call attention to the fact that we've seen just great advances in more effective and less toxic or less side effect intensive medicines for treatment and control of CLL over the last 10 years, with including the regulatory approvals in the last year in the United States we've talked about during this talk, and then as Dr. Hample highlighted, new drugs potentially additional tools in the armamentarium coming, in the near future. I think it's, an exciting time within CLL where we have these options to help people live hopefully longer and better.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And Dr. Hample.
Yes, great points. Once again, it's been a privilege to share the line with Dr. Ryan and Dr. Jensen this afternoon, and all of you folks who joined the call. I echo the same sentiments where, sometimes when we focus, especially in a relapse setting, we're talking about multiple lines of therapy, we can lose sight of how effective the drugs that we have and how well tolerated these are, and that many people will be very well served with essentially any of these options that are provided to you. So this is where it is key, really critical to discuss with your team who knows you best, and with the people most important to you, your family and friends, what's the right fit for you. Because from an efficacy perspective, they're all going to do a pretty good job of controlling the disease and treating it. And so what makes the most sense for you? And a well-designed clinical trial that is the right fit, is always important to consider too. So I think anytime you're at that juncture, especially of considering the first treatment or next treatment, to see, is this the right time to discuss a trial, either at your center that you're being seen at, or potentially a referral to a center of excellence or tertiary care center where they'd have more options and be able to discuss the latest and updates and what could be a beneficial trial to you too.
Thank you so much. And Mr. Chong.
The CLL treatment landscape is evolving, and every patient is unique. Again, CLL Society welcomes all people affected by CLL to visit our site and engage with our free resources to help them through their journey. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been terrific today. You've all been terrific today. So you've all been really terrific today, and just wonderful speakers. And but I do want to make a few comments. I want to thank our speakers, and I want to thank our participants as well. So perhaps most importantly, for those of you who had a chance to ask a question, please take your question back to your treating healthcare team. I think it came up a few times during the program, where we'd like you to take your question and bring it back to your treating healthcare team. So you've learned a lot today, and we want you to take that information back to your treating healthcare team. In addition, we also want you to know that you've learned a lot today, so you want to take what you've learned today back to your treating healthcare team and ask your question now, so that the team really, they know you the best, and they have your chart in front of them, and they can best answer your questions. In addition, importantly as well, for those who didn't get to ask your question, or in queue and didn't get to ask your question, again, you've learned a lot, so take your question back to your treating healthcare team. That's really important. And then the other thing I just want to stress with all of you is that we want you to you know, you can always reach your healthcare team during the day, but weekends, evenings, and holidays are difficult for people. So we want you to know that you want to ask your healthcare team who's available, evenings, weekends, and holidays. Also, I don't want anyone to leave the call thinking that you are alone. You are now a part of community support. You have the CLL Society and Cancer Care to help you. The CLL Society has a wealth of information for you to access. So again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all for your participation on today's program.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.